to Background Briefing. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. Find the program anytime at backgroundbriefing.org. And we have lots coming up for you this hour. First, the latest in the Mueller-Russia investigation. Prosecutors are cutting up that plea deal with former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. Prosecutors say Manafort was still lying even after he started cooperating in the Russia investigation. So they say Manafort now will be sentenced soon. Dan Friedman of Mother Jones covers national security and foreign influence, and he's going to talk with us about the Manafort-Mueller issues, also about reports that Manafort met with WikiLeaks' Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Then, retraining journalists to cover this president. We'll have a conversation with linguist George Lakoff about when to call a lie a lie, how lies or false statements stick in people's heads, and the best way to serve up the truth. And then a wave of lawsuits coming against the pharmaceutical industry now 20 years after prescription opioids were first marketed. Opioid addiction is a leading cause of death. The epidemic has devastated families, destroyed communities. We're going to talk with reporter Chris McGreal. He has a new book out. It's called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Starting off this evening, we're joined by Dan Freeman. He's a reporter for Mother Jones, the D.C. Bureau. He covers foreign influence and national security. His latest article is Bombshell Report, Paul Manafort Met Secretly with WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, first off, we want to talk about the former Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort. His sentencing may be coming up soon. His plea deal blew up. Prosecutors say he lied while he was supposed to be cooperating. And that may be shocking sounding to people, but anyone who knows Paul Manafort's history, maybe it's not such a surprise. What are your thoughts?
I think that's right. Manafort is fairly well known. He has been accused of, even while after he was indicted, he was accused of trying to interfere with witnesses in the money laundering and illegal lobbying case against him. He seems to have an inability to stop doing things that Mueller alleges are illegal. So, it's, as you noted, it's no big surprise that he allegedly lied to the special counsel after agreeing to cooperate fully and honestly with them.
It could land him in prison for the rest of his life?
That's correct. You know, he hasn't been sentenced yet, so we don't know what he could get, but the guidelines suggest, you know, he could have a sentence of certainly more than a decade, more than 20 years even, depending. And for a guy his age, that could be effectively a life sentence.
And Trump is, of course, rankled by this. Tell us about the president's reaction.
He has tweeted a lot, and he said that he's distressed by how terribly Paul Manafort is being treated. His lawyer, lead lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, reiterated today that Trump felt that Manafort was being treated terribly. This has caused speculation that Trump is planning to pardon Manafort, and that perhaps one of the reasons that Manafort has been uncooperative and even misleading with the special counsel is that he expects Trump to pardon him, so that he's trying to sort of play both sides here, that he felt he needed to cut a deal, but that maybe he's hoping that he still has some kind of secret deal with Trump, where if he doesn't implicate Trump, he'll still get pardoned. The charges against him, theoretically, he's pled guilty to things that he could be charged for in state court, such as tax evasion in Virginia, where he lives or lived before he was imprisoned.
Which would mean Trump couldn't pardon him.
That's correct. He could pardon him for the federal crimes, and he would still be pardoned for that, but he cannot pardon him for state crimes. So that's hopefully a backup option for prosecutors.
I've seen some coverage that said that perhaps Manafort saw himself, or Trump saw Manafort, as a mole within the Mueller investigation, reporting information back somehow. Is that possible?
Yeah, that could be. It's speculative, but I mean, it seems possible. One of the things that Mueller is communicating with this filing yesterday is that they have information that shows them that what Manafort is telling them isn't true. They have another source of information, and we don't know exactly what they say he lied about, but it certainly raises the possibility that they have sources of information that Manafort doesn't know about, didn't know about, and therefore the president, his lawyers may not have known about. The president just submitted a bunch of written answers to Mueller about what he knew or didn't know about collusion with Russia, so there is speculation. It's certainly possible that the special counsel waited until Trump had done that, and then they sort of sprung what could be called a trap and revealed that they have this information that contradicts what Manafort was saying, and that Manafort's, if he was spying within the investigation, passing information to Trump, that they sort of allowed Trump to be misled into providing potentially inaccurate information to the special counsel.
So it's a question of who might be one-upping or besting the other, right?
Yeah, so it might be that Trump thought he was one-upping Mueller, but in fact Mueller was besting him. And, you know, you can't make somebody lie, but if he were lying, you know, he may have stumbled into trouble if he was relying on Manafort's assertions that he wasn't giving Mueller information.
So put all this into the context of the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger picture is, I think the main thing is we don't know. We are, I think everybody who follows this stuff is waiting breathlessly to see what Mueller puts in his sentencing report that is due any day, we're not exactly clear when, on, you know, that explains how he thinks Manafort lied. And the reason is that he has to say there how he knows that Manafort is lying, and that'll show us hopefully a whole lot about what, you know, what kind of information Mueller has put together. So I think it's not a good day for the president and people in the White House who are hoping he'll get out of this Russia scandal scot-free, but we still really don't know exactly how that's going to shake out.
And that's something the Mueller folks have done before, right? Use the opportunity of court filings to release some information. Otherwise, they run a pretty tight ship in terms of releasing information. But sometimes reporters have been able to get more around those times when there are some court filings.
Yeah, they've been quite strategic about it. I think they put out information, you know, that they drop nuggets in there that demonstrate they know stuff. They seem to have an idea of what they're doing. So, you know, they seem to put in at times things that they don't necessarily need to include. So they certainly have some reason for including, for example, when they revealed that Konstantin Kolemnik, Manafort's former partner in Ukraine, had Russian intelligence ties. They didn't need to include that when they did back, I think it was last spring. But they did it, and for some reason they felt it was useful to reveal that at that time.
We're talking with Dan Friedman. He's a reporter with Mother Jones in D.C., covering foreign influence and national security. Of course, we're talking about the latest developments with Paul Manafort and the Mueller investigation. And also, there is some reporting going on about Manafort possibly meeting with Julian Assange in London at the Ecuadorian embassy. Tell us about that.
The Guardian, Luke Harding, another reporter with The Guardian, reported this morning that Manafort had, according to sources, or they said particularly one well-placed source, as they described it, Manafort met with Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been confined since 2013. I think they said three times, including most recently on or about March 2016, so right around the time when Manafort was joining the Trump campaign, and around not long before the Trump campaign learned that Russia had much dirt on Hillary Clinton, supposedly. Manafort and WikiLeaks have strenuously denied the Guardian report. They've both claimed it's libelous and threatened to sue the Guardian. And I don't know how much, you know, any other publications, it sounds to me like, are a bit gun-shy about going with that because of how strenuously they denied it, and because the sourcing on the story is a little nonspecific, and it sounds like the main claim there is based on one source.
So what could the timeline be in terms of Mueller releasing his final findings in his investigation?
We've seen reports that he has a report written. He could release his findings. I don't think it's going to be before Christmas, but I think, you know, people are starting to look for that in the next few months. There had been talk that he could wrap up this year. That's probably, if you're hoping for him to wrap up quickly, optimistic. But I think, you know, this winter is possible. But I think, again, it's a situation where we really have no idea at all. I have no idea at all when he's going to wrap up.
And what could the possible outcomes be once he does?
Well, he could submit a report to Congress, but it's not necessarily the case that he will submit a report to Congress. He could, you know, everyone is assuming that Mueller doesn't think he can indict Trump, but we don't know that to be the case. He could issue a series of indictments. He could indict the president as a co-conspirator, unnamed co-conspirator. He could not indict the president. He could do something in between. He could indict a few more people and leave Trump out of it if he doesn't think that he has any evidence that Trump committed a crime. So the sort of range, I think, is between nothing at all, which is unlikely, a report to Congress, and then a report to Congress and indictments up to and including President Trump.
There's been some concern that some of his findings would never be made public.
Yeah, I think that obviously is a concern a lot of people have expressed. I think with a Democratic House of Representatives, that the chances of that are a lot lower because he can report to the House, and the House can request his report, and I think Republicans would have a hard time preventing that from occurring. I think, without getting too far into the weeds on the ins and outs of that, I think it would be difficult for anybody to stop his report from becoming public. But, you know, we don't know for sure.
Let's zero in a little bit on the timeline, if you will. The alleged meeting between Manafort and Assange happened in March of 2016, and then Stone came out with his declaration on Twitter, preparing people to look out for new information coming soon, and then there was the infamous Trump Tower meeting. Tell us about the timeline.
Yeah, sure. And it's an intriguing timeline. It was supposedly around March of 2016, but they were a little, the story says, you know, that was a guess or an approximation. And you know, exactly when that was is quite important. George Papadopoulos, the Trump campaign aide, who heard from someone who sounds like they were a Russian intelligence agent, that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton, heard that, I believe it was around the end of March of 2016, and then he passed it on to members of the Trump campaign in meetings, including to Manafort. So Manafort would have heard from Papadopoulos that the Russians were offering this. The Russians, at some point, according to U.S. intelligence and Mueller's indictments, passed that information on to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks released documents related to the Democratic National Committee in late July of 2016. And then WikiLeaks released a bunch more documents, mostly related to John Podesta, the Clinton campaign chairman, beginning in early October 7th of 2016. Roger Stone had predicted repeatedly beginning in August that there were releases forthcoming to WikiLeaks. So the big question is, did Stone know that these things were forthcoming? Now that we know that Manafort reportedly had these meetings, did Manafort take some steps to facilitate the passing of hacked emails from Russia to WikiLeaks, knowing that WikiLeaks was a good way to get them out? He denied that strenuously today, but I think the Guardian report and other news that's coming out raises that question.
And tell us, Dan, what are we seeing in the near term? What's going to be happening next?
I think everyone is anticipating indictments from Mueller any day now. And I think right-wing conspiracy theorist Jerome Corsi, who was responsible for the swift boating of John Kerry in 2004 and one of the early guys to push the birther rumor about Obama in 2008, has said that he expects to be indicted for perjury, and it sounds like he told prosecutors that he had not had contact with WikiLeaks and he had not acted on an instruction or request from Roger Stone, who he knows, to ask WikiLeaks for information about when they were going to release emails. This would have been in August of 2016. But in fact, and this is a report out from NBC News today, it seems that Corsi told Stone in August in an email that he had learned that WikiLeaks was going to be releasing a couple tranches of stolen emails, including one tranche in October. So Corsi seems to have lied, and he's has said that he's negotiating a plea deal. He seems to be talking to half the reporters in D.C. about it and telling them what he's doing with Mueller. So of course he seems like he's certainly going to be indicted or plead guilty to perjury. And then Roger Stone certainly, I think, has to worry that he's going to be indicted at the same time or shortly thereafter. You know, Stone could be indicted. He's been accused of perjury. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, says he thinks Stone lied to the committee when he testified there in 2017. It's a sort of whole range of legal issues that Stone has to worry about, so it's a little unclear what he would be indicted for, but it's sort of like a multiple choice test, and it might be all of the above.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dan Friedman.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking with Dan Friedman, a reporter for Mother Jones at the D.C. Bureau. I'm Shirley Jihad. Coming up in a moment, whether it's the Mueller investigation, children at the border, or Ivanka Trump's emails, what's the best strategy to bring forth the truth in the face of falsehoods by the president?
¶¶ don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah. Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have. Yeah, watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Shirley Jihad in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is George Lakoff. He is Professor Emeritus of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's written several books, The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic. He also has a new edition out, the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant, and he is the author of The Political Mind. Welcome back to the program, George Lakoff.
A pleasure, Shirley.
Also, you're co-hosting a podcast now, the Frame Lab podcast. So we encourage people to take a listen to that with your co-host, Gil Duran. Now, we have a lot to talk about in terms of coverage of the President of the United States and the conundrum that journalists are facing on a day-to-day basis about how to cover the president without giving wings to falsehoods or misstatements or perhaps lies. You have talked about something called a truth sandwich. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure, but let me first motivate it. One thing that you can't do is simply negate a lie. I have a book called Don't Think of an Elephant, right? And you think of an elephant. If you negate a lie, you reinforce the lie. That is, in your brain, in order to negate something, neurally, to inhibit it, you have to activate it first. And that just strengthens it in your brain. So basically, whatever you do, don't just negate the lie. That's false, here's the truth.
So
you got to do better than that.
The problem is repeating the same statement that someone else says sort of solidifies that statement in people's minds. The brain doesn't hear the don't part of think of an elephant. They think of an elephant, so they hear crooked Hillary, and sooner or later that's a refrain that is implanted in their brain?
That's correct. You know, if you hear it, it's going to be, and you understand it, it's going to be in your brain. So that's the first thing to understand about how brains work, you know, and Trump takes advantage of this at all times. So if you're going to deal with the lies, you have to do something else. The first thing you have to do is frame first. That is, get the truth out there first. That's why you have to have a truth sandwich. So given a lie, you look at the corresponding truth, and you state that truth first. So that gets in people's brains first. Then you can say, by the way, the president said something that doesn't fit this truth. He said the following, which deviates from the truth in the following ways. And then you say how it deviates from the truth. Then you say, and you can see the importance of the real truth. Here's the real truth. That's the end of the truth sandwich. And then you say why the truth matters as opposed to the lie.
So let's run through an example. We have people at the border. Trump refers to them in a certain way. If we were going to implement the truth sandwich, help me out here, Professor. I would say families are arriving at the border. Trump has tweeted raging at the migrants, calling them stone-cold criminals.
Right.
There's no evidence to support their criminals? Or how do I make the sandwich?
The main thing is, as you start with, refugees from violence and crime in countries like Guatemala are coming north, poor people with very little on their backs, with their children, to try to come to America, to try to get a new life. And there are a lot of them coming. And they're weeks away from being at the border, and they're not just coming to one place at the border. They're coming to various different places where they might know people in the United States. So these are, you know, people who are simply poor, and then they have children and their families, and that's about all they have. Now, the president has called this an invasion, and he's called these people who are refugees criminals. They are anything but criminals. They're simply poor people who've been victimized in their country, who have children and family members, and who are trying to get a better life. Right? And it's important to remember that about them. And they're not all going to the same place. They're going to places that are near where they may know people in the U.S. Okay? And it's important to remember the difference between these poor people who want to come to the U.S. to start a new life, to get jobs, to enter our economy, to work hard for probably not very much money, which would help people throughout the U.S. as well as help themselves, and to become part of our country, as immigrants have in the past. So it is, you know, very important to remember that these are people who will make a positive contribution to our country, and in no way is there anything wrong or illegal or immoral about them. That's a truth sandwich.
That's the truth sandwich. So have journalists been succeeding or failing at putting the sandwich around some of the statements?
They've been failing because they haven't been trained to do this. If you go to journalism schools, journalists are trained to simply quote public officials. As soon as they quote the lies, they're helping establish the lies. So what they're doing with somebody like Trump is simply helping him, given their journalistic training. And so they need some retraining.
So the basic...
They need a way to avoid just quoting him, or even quoting him and saying, this is wrong because of X. I mean, you got to do better than that. That's why you need a truth sandwich.
So the basic conventions of journalism are being exploited on some level.
You've got it exactly. Trump knows the basic conventions of journalism, and he exploits them every day.
Some say just ignore him, but that's tough when you're covering the president of the United States. Does ignoring some things that he says, can that possibly work in this media landscape?
Well, it's difficult because he has a lot of followers who are not ignoring him, who are retweeting what he says and putting what he says on Facebook, and there are a lot of right-wing commentators out there, and there's Fox News and so on. So it's not so simple to ignore him, since the people on the right are not ignoring him.
When can you call a lie a lie? That's been a subject of debate in journalism, using words like falsehood or misstatement or misspeaking or just saying lie.
A lie is usually something that is intended to mislead. A falsehood, you may think it's true and it may happen to be false, but it may not be intended to mislead.
And so a journalist who's thinking of themselves as neutral wouldn't put themselves in the position to assume they would know someone's intention of misleading or not misleading.
The problem is journalism is never neutral. That's something journalists don't understand. Reporting the truth is not neutral. Very important. Reporting the truth is never neutral. Truths matter. They have political importance, social importance, intellectual importance. Reporting the truth is not neutral. It is a job that journalists do. It is crucial to freedom of the press. It is crucial to living in a democracy.
We're talking with George Lakoff, Professor Emeritus of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. You're talking about truth and how it matters and how journalists are charged with ferreting out truth. Dictionary.com just announced its word of the year, and that word is misinformation.
What's interesting about the word misinformation is that it is deliberate. That is, it's not just false information. It's not just accidentally false information. It's deliberate misinformation. And that misinformation, therefore, has a purpose. And therefore, this is purposeful communication, trying to inform one of something false with a purpose to achieve. And there are various purposes that you can imagine that might be achieved. But the point is that the information matters. the term misinformation has a frame behind it. That is, the assumption behind the concept of misinformation is that the information you get matters. Can matter to your life, it can matter to society, it can matter to politics, it can matter in all kinds of ways. So misinformation is not just information that happens to be wrong. It's information that has a social or political or personal purpose to harm and to get advantage for someone else, you know, as opposed to helping people in general by telling the truth.
And what about obfuscation? That's a whole other level that seems to be at play here when we hear the president talk about Khashoggi's killing and the Saudi prince and this sort of maybe there was involvement, maybe not. There's no way to know.
Right.
So that's a refrain heard in various issues.
There are various communicative strategies that Trump has. One of them is framing first, getting his way of understanding the situation out there first. The second is deflection. That is, saying something that is irrelevant to hide the importance of some truth that needs to be known. A third is attacking the messenger, you know, attacking the fake news New York Times or something like that. You attack the messenger. And the fourth is a trial balloon, that is an attempt to establish some idea that isn't established now and that may be a little far out there, but you try it out. You know, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. You know, something like that is one possible kind of trial balloon. You know, maybe the Saudis weren't responsible for this, you know, and so on. And that's another kind of trial balloon. So those are the four communicative strategies that Trump has. They are framing first, deflection, that is, you know, getting some other idea out there to cover up an important truth, attacking the messenger, and trial balloon.
And how would you rate Trump's success? Would you call his rhetorical strategies successful? I'm thinking of some surveys that found quite a high percentage of people are leaning toward believing statements like the press is the enemy of the people.
Well, there are several things to be said about that first. The first thing to do is to understand that Trump has a worldview, what I call strict father morality, in which some people are better than other people. There's a sort of hierarchy of who's better than who. And that worldview, and it comes from the idea of a strict father family, in which the father is the authority, an authoritarian ruler over the family, and what he says goes. And here, Trump is the nation's strict father, and what he says goes, and what he says is moral, is right. He is the arbiter of right and wrong. So then you might ask, well, how many people have a strict father worldview like Trump's? And the general answer over the past 30 years or so has been approximately 37% plus or minus 2. So somewhere up, you know, 37 to 39% to start with. Could go up a little bit higher. But that is, those are the people who start with accepting that worldview, who are not only accepting it, but who live it, whose identity is defined by thinking that way. So he starts with a good 37% of the country who will accept his way of thinking. That's a lot.
And are they growing more solidified with every word or with every campaign that he does, with every rally?
Well, a little bit, but not much. It may, you know, you've seen numbers like 39 to 40 sometimes, but it's not growing very much. It's sort of within that range, maybe growing a little bit.
And then what about response, you know, from Democrats? Should people be calling out, for instance, crooked Ivanka, because what about those emails?
Well, you call out crooked Ivanka, and it evokes crooked Hillary.
Ah.
You know, it's...
So that wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work. I mean, what you, you know, you could, I mean, you could talk about Ivanka's, you know, emails and stuff like that, but it's not just crooked Ivanka. I mean, it's the whole crooked Trump family. But I think it is important to point out that she is using the same thing as Hillary. As soon as you say crooked Ivanka, you're echoing crooked Hillary. People hear crooked Hillary unconsciously. It's not a good idea. You need to say something different about Ivanka's personal emails, since she is an official in the White House. And there needs to be a way to frame that so that you can see that what she's doing is problematic.
We've been talking about Mueller and Manafort and, of course, the president's words on Mueller, who is investigating the president. The president describes as doing tremendous damage to the criminal justice system. It
yes.
seems like things get turned on their heads. Is that that's an example of his framing?
Oh, yeah. What he always does is if he's accused of something by someone, he turns the same accusation back on the other person. So Mueller, you know, becomes the rogue. So you're gonna get that. And that's a normal tactic of his.
So there's this mirroring?
Yes. He just, you know, says he just turns it around on the other person. He's done that many, many times.
And again, the response to that should be?
The response to that should be a positive, not to recognize it and not to echo it, but to talk positively about Mueller. You have to say the scrupulously honest and honorable prosecutor, special attorney Mueller. There are certain general principles here. The first one is frame first. That's why you get your truth out first in the truth sandwich. That is, framing first means that the people who hear you get that idea in their brain first, and then understand everything else relative to that. So that in the truth sandwich, you start out with the truth, and then you understand the lie relative to the truth, and then you reinforce the truth, and you tell its importance.
And would that penetrate what seems like an impenetrable base that Trump has?
No. It's not going to penetrate his base. His base is always going to be his base. His base starts out with his worldview and with believing him. That's 37% plus or minus 2. It's the rest of the folks, the over 60% of people who are open to hearing the truth.
And so there's no going back to sort of meet those people?
Well, it's difficult. It's very hard to do that. There is a possibility, and that depends on their communities. In conservative communities, you have the phenomenon of what I call in-group nurturance or in-group care, where people in any conservative community have real needs and real difficulties, and other people try to help them. And you see this in, let's say, conservative churches all the time. And the question is, can you talk about the kinds of difficulties that people in conservative communities would have in the same ways? I haven't tried to do that. It's an interesting possibility, but it takes some research.
We have so much to talk about with you whenever you join us. Thank you for your time, Professor Lakoff.
Always a pleasure, Shirley. Thanks for the conversation.
We've been talking with George Lakoff. He is professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, and the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. Also, he's co-host of the podcast, The Frame Lab. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. Up next, we talk with Guardian journalist Chris McGreal about his new book, just out, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Welcome back. I'm Shirley Jihad in for Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. You can find it online at backgroundbriefing.org. Chris McGreal is a reporter for The Guardian. He's a former journalist with the BBC. He's been The Guardian's correspondent in Washington, D.C., in Jerusalem, in Johannesburg. He writes now for The Guardian from across the United States. He's done a lot of writing about the opioid crisis, and he's just released a new book this month. It's called American Overdose: The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
So we're going to get talking about the latest involving lawsuits and possible criminal cases involving Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family. But first, we want to set the table. I think it's really important, as much as people hear bit by bit about the opioid crisis, just to have the sweeping big picture, the numbers for us. Can you set the table and describe the extent of the problem? We're talking about the leading cause of death for people under 50, particularly white people, and now 200 people a day are dying from opioid overdoses. Employers saying they're having trouble hiring people because they can't find workers who can pass the drug tests. Can you kind of break down the numbers and implications for us?
Yes, certainly. In the end, I don't think anybody's really sure about the numbers, because for many years this was an underreported tragedy, partly because of stigma around drug overdoses. But the Centers for Disease Control ballpark figure is that 350,000 people have died over the past 15 years from opioid overdoses. And last year alone, we had somewhere in the region of 72,000 drug overdoses, of which more than 60,000 were from opioids. And that was 15,000 of those, roughly, were from prescription pills, roughly the same number from heroin, and then double that number, around 30,000 were from the artificial synthetic opioid fentanyl. And both heroin and fentanyl have been the really surging killers recently, but that's gone some way to overshadow the fact that actually deaths from prescription pills have been pretty consistently the same for several years now, and that for many years, for nearly two decades, they were the biggest killer of all.
And so let's go back to the beginning. Actually, the opioid crisis begins about 20 years ago, right, with the beginning of the sale of OxyContin.
Yes, one of the shocking things for me, and one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, was realizing when I was reporting on this from places like West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, the crucible of the epidemic, that it had begun 20 years ago, that there were communities that had been struggling for two decades with the impact of prescription opioids on families and individuals and whole communities. And I wonder how it was that this had gone on for nearly 20 years, and it's only now, really, that we're talking about it in these terms. And the other thing that leapt out at me in looking at that was that this is pretty much a uniquely American phenomenon. It's 85% of the world's prescription opioids are consumed in the United States, and the U.S. is only 5% of the global population. And so looking at that, you go back 20 years and you see a couple of things happen, one of which is you have a group of doctors who press the case for the much wider prescribing of opioids to treat chronic pain. They believed that there was an unreasonable stigma around these drugs, born of an earlier epidemic of more than a century ago, which had followed the use of morphine to treat soldiers with wounds after the Civil War. And that led to a prohibition, really, on the use of morphine, even for treating pain, except in very limited circumstances, until in the 1960s you see the rise of the hospice movement in the UK, which helps people who are dying, particularly of cancer, which says addiction is not really an issue if you're dying, so you can give as many of the drugs as is required to deal with the pain. And that movement moves across into the US, but then becomes a much wider cause of these doctors press the case for prescribing opioid pills for a much wider variety of pain, particularly daily chronic pain that so many people live with and which is so debilitating physically and mentally.
But that is one of the remarkable parts of your work, right? Just hearing about the PR campaign and how it moved public opinion and particularly first the medical community, right? Just about the effort to destigmatize, as you say, narcotics and painkillers, that opioids were sold as non-addictive and that they were okay, and that it was as if it was old thinking for doctors to be afraid of addiction issues. It was quite a remarkable PR push.
It was indeed, and it was all based on actually sort of very, very weak science. There was a group of doctors who took some studies and essentially...
A tiny study.
Tiny studies. They one of their studies suggested that only 1% of people who use opioids were likely to become addicted, but it turned out that that was based on a single letter in the New England Journal of Medicine, and that study was of a very small group of people who were in hospital and who would have had very controlled access to opioids, so it was almost worthless. And similarly, this notion arised of pseudo-addiction, and what this pseudo-addiction was argued was that you couldn't become addicted to narcotics if they were treating pain, that the pain cancelled out the risk of addiction. And what that said, the argument made out of that then was that you can give as many narcotics, as higher doses as required to treat the pain without the risk of addiction. This was completely pseudoscience. It was junk science, and it was based in the end, on a single patient, single cancer patient. That was the entire study. But these various studies were congealed into this kind of comprehensive argument that the old ways, the old attitudes towards morphine and opioid pain treatment were out of date, and these drugs could now be used very widely and safely. And it took hold.
And how is it that so many doctors were basically snowed, if you will? I mean, actually, my mom is a doctor, very old school. She didn't go for whatever the drug company sort of dangled in front of the doctors and recognized some of the salesmanship that was involved there.
Well, I think one of the explanations for why this is a uniquely American epidemic is that actually the medical health care system in this country is an industry rather than a health service. And that meant in this case that the drug industry got hold of medical policy. And so it's quite surprising to discover that at least until this crisis became what it is now, your average doctor in this country during 4 years of medical training as a primary care doctor would probably only spend 2-3 days on pain, being educated on pain. So when the drug company salesman came along repeating the spiel from these doctors on this very weak science, saying, look, these drugs are safer and more effective, the doctors really had no other education in this to fall back on. They ended up listening to the salesman. And the salesmen were not doctors, but they were quoting these papers, and the doctors themselves took these at face value. And that was enhanced by something else the drug companies, particularly Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, the big, powerful drug that changed this epidemic, was able to do. It persuaded the Food and Drug Administration, which authorizes drugs, that OxyContin was both more effective and safer than other opioids on the market. Now, there was no evidence for this, and the FDA didn't require any studies. It simply agreed to that. That was put on what is known as the label and the conditions under which a drug is used. And so Purdue Pharma salesmen were able to go to doctors and say, look, the FDA says that this drug is safer and more effective than other opioids. You should use it. But those claims actually were just cooked up in the Purdue Pharma's marketing department. So what you see in the end is that the industry actually decides medical policy and goes out and persuades the doctors of it.
We're talking with Chris McGreal. He's a reporter for The Guardian and has a new book out called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. So you're talking about salesmanship and marketing. Let's go back and hear the story of the Sackler brothers who started Purdue Pharma. They're physicians. They were physicians, psychiatrists, right? And one was a great marketer, right? What we call marketing today, it might have been called like a carnival barker in olden days. But tell us about how the salesmanship was key from the beginning.
There were three brothers, and the older brother was both a psychiatrist and a doctor, but he also developed a real talent for selling. And he actually was the individual who brought Valium to popularity in the United States. And he ran a marketing campaign that was incredibly effective, persuading people who might not be feeling great that Valium was their solution. And the key to this was something that would later be applied with opioids, which was not only to sell to the market that was going to buy it anyway. He recognized, Arthur Sackler, the elder brother, he recognized that you should sell it to people who didn't really need it or weren't likely to take it. And so he ran an advertising campaign which wasn't aimed at those who were most in need of Valium. It was aimed at those who would be a good market for it. The advertising campaign focused on things such as, were you feeling depressed? Were you feeling a little nervous? Any condition that might have you not feeling great, Valium was the answer. And that led to, you know, a huge surge in sales for this drug. And that really was the first mass-marketed drug in this kind of way. And then he had two younger brothers who took control of a small company called Purdue Pharma. And at that point, it really wasn't in the drug business. And that became the launching point for OxyContin. And they essentially used those same sales tactics developed by Arthur to sell opioid drugs. They and it's in the marketing memos, internal memos inside the company that have now we now know as a result of prosecutions that they looked at this drug and they said it's no good just selling it to those who are going to take it anyway, who were people, principally people dying of cancer who need very high strength opioids. We need to widen the market. We need to get this in as many hands as possible. And they end up essentially running a campaign saying that a very, very high strength opioid drug was the drug to begin with and stay with. So not that this is a kind of last resort. If all other else has failed, then it's extremely powerful. But actually, if you're in pain, have this drug. And its marketing, the marketing campaign was built around making access to this drug as wide as possible.
And it's that marketing campaign that was the subject of a prosecution, right? There was a criminal conviction about 10 years ago.
That's right. In 2007, a U.S. attorney in Virginia, John Brownlee, took a look at what was happening in that part of Virginia and said, this is all down to one thing, which is Purdue Pharma and its marketing campaign to doctors. And so he went back and looked at what Purdue was saying in its advertising material, in its claims to doctors, what the salesman was saying, and that's how we know what was in the marketing memos. And he prosecuted them for illegally promoting the drug, for making claims for the drug that just were not proven by the science. Purdue Pharma pleaded guilty. It paid $600 million in a fine, which sounds massive, but when you consider that by then it was pulling in $2, $3 billion a year from the drug, it's really quite a small amount. And three executives were also convicted, but none of them went to prison. And at that point, even then, there were questions in Congress about how it is a drug could be marketed like this and nobody is actually held responsible beyond paying fines that were characterized as merely the cost of doing business.
Well, now today there are some massive lawsuits, right, consolidated and going forward, coming up probably early next year. Tell us about that.
Out of this crisis, has one of the things that has happened is all of these towns and cities, particularly in places like West Virginia, Ohio, Eastern Kentucky, across parts of New England, they've been left with the blight of opioid addiction, and it's not just the deaths, as horrific as the number of deaths is. There are 2 or 3 million people in this country who are dependent or hooked on these drugs, and that has a much wider impact. It leaves children who need to be taken into care by the state because their parents are either dead or unable to look after them. In parts of West Virginia, I was reminded, I used to work in Africa in the 1990s, and I would go to villages in Uganda where there was a missing generation because of AIDS. You had grandparents bringing up grandchildren, and I wouldn't want to overstate it and compare West Virginia directly, but there are towns in West Virginia where there are a significant number of children being brought up by grandparents because of that missing generation. Often the burden falls onto the state social services. There are a whole slew of other costs to states, and they started to look at who should pay for this, particularly as there was really wasn't any national leadership at the time. And so they instigated a number of lawsuits, essentially against Purdue Pharma, against other drug makers, but also against the drug distributors, the companies that farmed out these pills to small pharmacies in places like West Virginia, where you had small towns of a few hundred people or even a few thousand people, where millions of pills were being dispensed from these pharmacies every year, out of all proportion to the population. And the argument in the lawsuits is these drug companies knew full well what was going on, and they were just making money out of it. And you now have a big consolidated lawsuit in Ohio that brings together actions by attorneys generals from across the U.S., plus a number of cities and towns. And that action, which I think includes now 400 different lawsuits, essentially is seeking a big tobacco-type settlement in the billions of dollars that these various jurisdictions are looking for to help fund the assistance, the treatment that people who are addicted need, but also the recuperation of communities. You also have a number of places that are pressing for criminal prosecutions. They want to see investigations of the drug executives responsible for this, because, as I said earlier, there's a wariness at the idea that big companies and their executives just view these civil settlements as the cost of doing business and then carry on as before, no matter what the human cost.
And you're talking about these communities that are hit hardest. I have a sense that if you overlay the map of voting on top of the communities hit hardest by the opioid crisis, you might find that those communities are the same that came out strongest for Trump. And we have some recent polling from NPR in the last month that shows those same communities really do want more government intervention, more help. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's certainly true. Yes, that's certainly true. One of the things that really struck me reporting this for the book was the sense of betrayal in those communities at the lack of protection from the government. You know, where were the institutions that are supposed to protect Americans from this kind of devastation? And when you look at it closely, what you see is that those institutions, the Food and Drug Administration, a whole bunch of federal agencies that deal with drugs in one form or other, like the National Institute for Drug Abuse, they weren't to be found. They were either complicit, as the FDA became, in the spread of opioids, or they simply stood in the background. And there's a real sense of betrayal amongst people in these communities, which I think has gone to further, it's not the only factor, but further undermine their confidence in the federal government. I think there's also a sense in those communities that they were targeted because they're poor and marginalized. And it's certainly true that when they were hit by this first wave in the late 90s and early 2000s, really the rest of the country didn't take too much notice. It wasn't an issue for the federal government. It wasn't an issue in Congress. And even though there were doctors and people of influence who are ringing the alarm bells, and I'm thinking, for instance, of a doctor called Jane Ballantyne, who was the head of pain at Harvard University, and saw that, in fact, far from the promised miracle cure, magic bullet, these drugs were actually not only creating dependence, but they were also not working against the pain long term. And she ends up writing a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2003, laying this out in great detail. And it should have been a warning sign. It should have been a reason for, if not the drug companies to pause, then the federal agencies to say, wait a second, particularly the FDA. And that doesn't happen. In fact, they changed the conversation. They make out that the people who became addicted were abusers of drugs, and it was their own fault. And so that they're to blame. They essentially blame the victims. And the juggernaut of mass selling of prescription drugs just carries on with the complicity of, like I say, the FDA and other federal agencies. And I think in those communities we're talking about, there was just a sense of abandonment and a real sense of betrayal that there was nobody to protect their interests, to speak up for them. And I'm sure that is one factor amongst several in the rise of support for the president.
You're talking about the federal response, and just in the last few weeks, we have the new bill and funding to fight the opioid epidemic. But some people are saying it doesn't quite measure up. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. I mean, I think the principal criticism of it is simply the scale of the funding. It's $8 billion, which on the face of it sounds like a lot of money, but there's the White House has an opioid commission, and it estimates that by the time this epidemic's run its course, it'll probably cost the United States $1 trillion. So you get the sense that $8 billion is really just a drop in the ocean compared to the cost to the country. At least this is being talked about. At least the stigma around addiction is being broken down. There's a recognition that there's a real issue with the scale of prescribing, even though actually that hasn't fallen seriously yet. But there still isn't either the resources or the sense of national leadership to deal with this epidemic.
We've been talking with Chris McGreal. He's got a new book out. It's called American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in 3X. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Ian Masters. Big thanks to producer Graham Fitzgibbon. The program is always available at backgroundbriefing.org. There you can sign up for email updates. Also, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the program, do go ahead and rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please go ahead and share the program with friends or family or colleagues via Twitter or Facebook. Tomorrow, journalist David Dayan is here hosting. He's a contributor to The Intercept, The Nation, and The New Republic. Be sure to listen.